This morning I would draw your attention once again to our studies in Paul's letter to the Galatians. We're in chapter 4, and this morning we turn to verses 8 to 11. We have spent the past two Sunday mornings looking at verses 4 to 7, where we saw what God did in the fullness of the time. He sent forth his Son, and he sent forth his Spirit. And we saw something of the significance of the fullness. The right time had come. And then last Sunday morning, we looked at these verses from the perspective of sonship. And we emphasized that sonship is God's ultimate purpose and desire for his creatures made in his own image. We were intended always to be God's children, right from creation. And redemption, both in the Old Testament and in the New Testament, is intended to make us the children of God. And it's this that is the real heart of the Christian message. And it is this that is often forgotten, or if not entirely forgotten, then certainly not given the place that it deserves to be given in our thinking. The Bible certainly emphasizes it. Behold, what manner of love the Father has bestowed upon us that we should be called the children of God. That is what it means to be a Christian, not simply a believer or a saint or a soldier or whatever other way we may wish to describe the significance of being a Christian. The real significance is that we are God's children. And that means, of course, that God is our Father. And that is how we pray. And that's what we've been emphasizing. And Paul has been leading up to that in these chapters 3 and 4, where we have seen that Paul in these two chapters, these two central chapters, is dealing with the issue of salvation. The opening two chapters deal with the question of Paul's authority, chapters 1 and 2. Chapters 3 and 4 deal with the issue of how are we going to be saved. Is it by law or by grace? Is it by promise or is it by our works? And chapters 5 and 6, as we are going to see in our studies, deal with the question of what really is the Christian life? How are we to live the Christian life? How can we live as the children of God? These are the issues, and that is why, as I've repeatedly emphasized in our studies thus far, this is why this epistle has been called the Charter of Christian Liberty. And Martin Luther, to quote that good man again, said this: Epistle to the Galatians is the second best book in the Bible. He thought the first best book was Romans. He who knows Romans knows the gospel. The second next in his line of priority and importance would be Galatians. Now, I'm not saying that he was right or wrong, but if he is not exactly right, then he's not far wrong. There's no question that Galatians is one of the great statements of the Christian faith. Well, we've been looking at the summary of the real heart of the Christian faith for the past two Sunday mornings, verses 4 to 7, and we come now to the following verses, 8 to 11. Now, there's a certain sense in which we could have gone straight on from verse 7 to verse 12. Supposing verses 8 to 11 had not been included in the text, you and I would not have been conscious of any omission or any kind of hiatus or lack in the apostle's argument. If you are no more a servant, but you're a son, if you are a son, then an heir of God through Christ. We could have gone on to verse 12, where Paul begins to appeal, brethren, I beseech you, be as I am. But Paul does not go straight on to his appeal that we'll look at next Sunday morning. He has got something else to say. He wants to remind these Galatians and us of something of tremendous importance. even although we would not miss these verses if they hadn't been put in, we wouldn't have known about them. But nonetheless, the point is they are put in. And when we read them, surely we see the tremendous magnitude and the significance of them. Because Paul here is not just winding down or rounding up a kind of concluding comment on the previous teaching. He is reaching a high point. This is the climax of Paul's argument before he comes to the appeal. Be as I am, because I have become as you are. This is the climax. This is what Paul has been leading up to in all that he has said hitherto in chapters 3 and 4. Paul says in verse 8 to 11, how is it then, he says, when you knew not God, you did service. That literally means you served as slaves. You were enslaved unto them which by nature are not gods. How is it then, but after now, that after you have known God, or rather you have come to be known by God, how is it that you again turn to the weak and beggarly elements, whereunto you desire again, and the word that he uses here is wish, you are willing to be enslaved again, to be in bondage once again to these weak and beggarly elements. How can this possibly be? You observe days and months and times and years. I am afraid of you, lest I have bestowed upon you labor in vain. And the word that Paul uses here for labor, bestowed upon you labor, is not just an ordinary word for work. There are other words that mean just doing something. The word that Paul uses here is a word that means strong, energetic, hard labor. In other words, he put his back into it. And that is why I was commenting during the reading that when Paul was preaching the gospel in these Galatian cities, in the Roman province of Galatia, present-day southern Turkey, he wasn't just, as it were, coming in, preaching a few sermons and building up some shady, shonky congregation. He was staying there for some considerable time, laying a good and a deep foundation, making sure that these converts understood what the gospel is, and he would not move on to another place until he was confident of their standing and their ability to stand in the gospel in his absence. It seems, of course, that shortly after Paul left, other teachers had come in and they had upset and indeed were trying to demolish and uproot the work that the apostle Paul and Barnabas had accomplished in these various congregations in Galatia. So it's this hard work that Paul is saying, I am beginning to fear, and the word that he uses is literally fear. I am becoming afraid. There is a kind of terror, there's a kind of apprehension beginning to grip my heart. And the fear is that all my labor among you people was in vain and it's going to come to nothing. And the fear probably would be that the Apostle Paul would have to go back again and go over the same places and the same teaching all over again to rebuild what he had originally built well that others were in danger of utterly destroying. And Paul might have to go back and reclaim ground that already was his and theirs in the gospel. That's the kind of language that the Apostle Paul is using. Now, why do I say that this is a vital passage of the message of Galatians? Because this, in a sense, is the heart. This is the real reason why Paul is writing the epistle at all. This is the explanation of this great epistle to the Galatians, these verses that we have before us. And you say, well, how in the wide world can you make that statement? Well, let's look at what Paul is saying. How are we going to analyze and break down these verses to see what is actually being said here? And the first thing I want to do is to look with you this morning at the situation. What is the situation? What is the condition into which the Apostle Paul is writing these great words? And what is the problem that he is addressing? Why is it that these Galatians, who began so well, are now seemingly wanting to go back to the kind of life that they lived before they ever became Christians? How is this possible, says the apostle? And the answer is, of course, it is possible. It is not desirable, but it is possible for Christian people who make some kind of profession, and it is a credible profession, they seem to have been changed, it is possible for them to go back into the old kind of lifestyle that they had before they ever knew of Christ. And so Paul is speaking of something. There is a reason why they are doing this. And the apostle Paul knows perfectly well what the reason is. He is asking them to understand, how is it that you want to go back to slavery once again? And then what then is the remedy? Because these are the implications. What is the remedy to prevent us ever going back if we have become Christians? What is the remedy, the only remedy that the gospel presents to us to continue in the faith and to keep going and to endure with long suffering the race that is set before us? Now, these are the kinds of issues that we want to be looking at this morning. I'm conscious of the brevity of time, and sometimes we become perhaps over-loquacious, and we want to be brief also in our use of language and as economical as we can. But I want to paint out that background in order to make sense of what we're going to try to be emphasizing this morning. So what is, first of all, what is the situation that Paul is talking about here? Well, the situation is, he's reminding them, as he's already reminded us at the beginning of the chapter, that there was a time before we became Christians and a time after we became Christians. You remember how we saw that in the closing verses of chapter 3 and in the opening verses of chapter 4. The heir, as long as he is a child, is no better than a slave. But then the time appointed by the father comes, and the heir enters in to his sonship. And he is no longer under the tutors and governors. In other words, he no longer is in the condition, even remotely like a slave. He is now seen to be the child and the heir of the Father. And Paul there, you remember, in these opening verses, was drawing that kind of comparison. Now, it's that same kind of thing again that the apostle is emphasizing here. Howbeit then, when you did not know God, you did service unto them which by nature are not gods, but now, so there is a then and a now. You did not know God then, but you now do know God. How then is it possible that having come to know God, you want to go back and to live as if you had never known God? That's the situation into which the Apostle Paul is addressing these verses. And I'm sure we all see the challenge, the danger, the relevance of this passage. This is what Galatians is all about. These Christians were backsliding into a gospel which is not another gospel. There is no other gospel. Now, notice carefully the language that Paul is using. He says here, howbeit then, when you knew not God, but now that you have come to know God. Now, in our English version, we would be excused, as I keep on saying, we would be excused if we assumed that the Apostle Paul is using the same language in verse 8 as he is using in verse 9, for knowing, but he's not. He uses two different words in the Greek language. In verse number 8, what he says literally is this: howbeit then, when you did not see God. The word that he uses here for knowing not is the word that can be, indeed, preferentially, is to be translated as seeing. So the way in which you can know something is by seeing it. So what Paul is saying is that there was a time when you did not know God because you didn't see. You didn't see the relevance of God. You didn't see the gospel. You didn't see the reality of sin and the danger of being a sinner. You just didn't see it. That is why Jesus, in his teaching, emphasizes so much of the blindness of the Pharisees. You remember how over and over again, especially in Matthew's Gospel chapter 23, he says, blind Pharisees. Why does he keep on using this particular metaphor of blindness? He is using it because the natural man does not see. He doesn't understand and know the things of God because he doesn't see them. He doesn't see himself as God sees him. He doesn't see his danger as God sees it. He doesn't see Christ in the way that God sees Christ, and indeed in the way that Christians see Christ. The Apostle Paul tells us in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 that there was once a time when we too, we regarded Christ just after the flesh. A good man, an important man, but not all that important that we should change our lives over him and put up with all the suffering that's involved in following him. We regarded him after the flesh, but now we regard him thus no more. Because if any man be in Christ, he's a new creature. And the old things are passed away and all things have become new. In other words, we begin to think differently because we see differently. Faith in the Bible is a way of hearing. It's a way of seeing. It's a way of thinking. It's a way of looking at things. The Bible uses all these illustrations to describe what it means to be a believer. We look at things and we think at things in a way entirely different. Now that's what Paul is saying here. There was a time when you did not see God. You did not know him. And not knowing God, you didn't know yourself. The psalmist reminds us, does he not, that it is in thy light that we see light. You and I will never see ourselves as we are in the eyes of the Bible. We will never see sin. We will never see salvation until we see God. You and I don't see God because, as it were, God makes himself known to us after we're converted. God makes himself known to us and then we become converted. The God of this world has blinded the minds of those who believe not. Blinded the minds. The natural man is blind to spiritual truth. But the God who in the beginning commanded the light to shine out of the darkness has shined in our hearts. And it's then that we begin to get the knowledge. So the first thing that Paul says, there was a time when you didn't know God because you simply couldn't see that knowing God was important in the slightest. And in that time, he says, in that way of living, at that time of your existence, you served. You were in, the word here for service means enslaved. You served as slaves unto them which by nature are no gods. Now, Paul is not saying that they weren't religious. They were religious. We know that from the account in the Acts of the Apostles. They were believers in other gods. But in reality, these things that the natural man worships are not gods. They are nothing more, the psalmist tells us, than the imaginations of men's hearts. And it's the same today as it always has been. If we do not worship the true God, we are going to worship something or someone which by very definition is not God. It is not God as he really is. That's what Paul is saying. You were enslaved and you were in bondage. These ideas of those beings or those imaginations of idolatrous worship which had nothing to do with the knowledge of the true God, they kept you in bondage. The knowledge of God is liberty from this kind of bondage. So this is what Paul is saying. And then he moves away from looking at what we once were like when we did not know God because we couldn't see the truth of the gospel and we were in bondage. We couldn't deliver ourselves. But now, he says, after having, he says, but now after that you have known God, or having been known by God. And the word here is for knowledge. It's the word for full knowledge. And notice where Paul is emphasizing and placing the emphasizing. He says, our knowledge of God doesn't begin with us. It begins with God knowing us. We come to know him because he first of all has known us. Everything about our Christian life, no matter from which angle you wish to look at it, everything in our Christian life is based upon God taking the initiative. We call upon him because he calls upon us. We come to him because he comes to us. We speak to him because he first of all speaks to us. We love him because he first of all has loved us. We are desiring to be his friend because he first of all desires to be our friend. Everything comes initially from God's initiative. And that is what Paul is saying. But you now do know God. You came to know God because you came to know God in Jesus Christ. He who has seen me has seen the Father. And you remember how Jesus himself tells us in John's Gospel, chapter 17. This is eternal life, that they might know thee, the only living and true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent. You see, it's not simply knowing about God. We can know a great deal about God. I know a great deal, and I'm sure you do, about Hitler and about Her Majesty the Queen and about many other people of whom you can read just about everything about their life. You can know what they have for breakfast. You can know whether they love corgis or not. You can know where they are and where they go. We know about them. But I would never claim to know Her Majesty the Queen. I don't know her intimately. I don't really know what she is like. I know about her, and I know her importance and her dignity and her place in the world, but I don't know her. I've never come into the intimate circle of personal acquaintance. And nobody ever will know anybody else unless that one reveals themselves to them. As A.W. Tozer points out in one of his books concerning the knowledge of God, you and I might know a great deal about many things, but the knowledge of God is not the kind of knowledge that you read about in a book. You might know all about how to repair a car engine, or how to build buildings, or how to do nuclear physics, and you learn that simply by studying it, experiments. But we come to know God not as a thing that is there to be studied, but as a person with whom we have dealings. To know God means to know him as one who, in a sense, is like ourselves. We know each other as persons in a way that we do not know other things simply as things. There is a mutual acquaintance and intimacy in personal knowledge one of the other. And that has degrees. We know some people better than others, but nonetheless, we know them not as things, but as persons. And it's exactly the same with God. God is not an idea. He is not a doctrinal proposition. He is our Father who is in heaven. And when we come to know him, our spontaneous cry is, Father, Abba, Father. It is an inward knowledge that God and ourselves have a particular relationship, Father to his children. And that is the knowledge of God that is a saving knowledge. That is what the Christian faith teaches. And that's why Jesus taught his disciples to pray not like other people do, but to pray as Christians, to pray our Father who art in heaven. Do you and I know that kind of intimate knowledge of God? Is God to us an object of study, systematic definitions, fine distinctions as to Trinitarian behavior, intra and extra Trinitarian attributes and activities, or is he one whom we know? I know whom I have believed. Is that our Christian faith? Because nothing less and nothing else will do. To know him and to know him better and to make progress in the Christian life is nothing more than knowing God better and better and better in this particular way. Christians often speak of knowing my Creator. I believe in the Creator. Well, of course we do. So do every other religion in the world just about believe in the Creator. There is nothing particularly Christian about believing in God or the Creator. There is everything Christian about being a child and a younger brother of our elder brother, Jesus Christ, God's first begotten beloved Son. That's what Paul is saying. And these Galatians, Paul is confident, they had come to this knowledge. And the reason that they had come to this knowledge was that they had turned away from these weak and beggarly elements, as he describes it. Remember, when we were looking in the opening verses, we concentrated a good part of the sermon on verse 3, under the elements of the world. We saw that this particular word, stoicheia, it occurs 7 times in the Greek New Testament, twice in 2 Peter chapter 3, twice in Colossians chapter 2, it occurs in Hebrews chapter 5, once, and it occurs twice in Galatians chapter 4, verses 3 and verse 9. And we saw that it meant the elementaries, the rudiments. It's like our periodic table of the elements, where you go from the simplest to the more complex kinds of atomic organization. Everything is reduced to its elements. It's basic. And Paul is saying that when you became a Christian, you turned away from basic religion that's common to man. And you turn to a religion that is not common to man. Something that is not man-made, but something that is God-revealed. You remember we emphasized that. And we're no longer, therefore, enslaved in our thinking or in our living to those traditions of men and those religious rules that men have a long tradition and habit of inventing and that they want to impose upon their fellow human beings. And unless you abide by their rules, you can't be saved. Paul is saying you came to know God and that was enough. You don't need these rules anymore because you're no longer a slave. These are for children. These are for slaves, not for mature sons of God. And so Paul is speaking of a real situation where he is assuming that there was a genuine conversion and that there was a difference made between what they were before they became Christians or what they are now that they have become Christians. But now here's the astonishing thing. They want to go back. He says, how is it that after you have known God, or rather are known by God, how is it possible that you're turning again to the weak and beggarly elements? And here he is using the word beggarly, and he is really describing them. They are weak, they can't help you. They are beggarly. The word literally in the Greek language means poor. They can't do anything for you. They can't help you. There's no ability. There's no power. There's no help in any other religion. All the law-keeping and legal rule-keeping in the world is of no value. And so what Paul is really saying is this, what is the point of having a religion that doesn't save you? If it is true that the purpose of a religion is in some way to have peace with the divine being, whoever he or she or they are, if that is the purpose of religion, what is the point of having a religion that doesn't save you, but in fact brings you into bondage, to foolishness, to superstition, and to those things that are not in any way God's? Paul is recognizing the possibility that this can happen. It is happening. But he is also recognizing the incongruity, the inbuilt contradiction. And Paul knows that they are turning away from the purity of the gospel because they are beginning to manifest certain activities in their lives which were characteristic of the days when they didn't know God. What were these? What were those? You observe days and months and times and years. In other words, they were beginning to emphasize externals in religion. And furthermore, Paul says, this is what you actually are willing and wishing to do. How can you turn again to the weak and beggarly elements wherein you desire? This word desire is the Greek word thelo, which means you're actually wanting to go back again. So this isn't some little innocent, ignorant, being led astray as little children, trusting everybody and everything. This seems to be a policy, a deliberate choice on their part. They are making a choice, and they are comparing their present condition as Christians to what it was like before they become Christians, and it seems that they are actually preferring what it was like before they became Christians. You are wishing to be as though you had never come to know Christ. And you are substituting Christ for your observation of days, months, times, years. Now, there's nothing wrong with the observance of days and months and years. But when the observance of externals and this kind of thing, whether it be from a Gentile perspective, from their religious practices, or from the Jewish observance of certain days and months and jubilee years and so on, or from a Christian perspective, then it means that we are turning away from the real heart of the gospel and substituting something in its place. There's nothing wrong with Sabbatarian observance. But if Sabbatarianism gets out of control and becomes one of the predominant themes of our thinking and becomes a dominant part of our life, then something has gone wrong. It was never intended to be that. Just to give an example, food and drink, the length of clothing, the length of hair, all these kinds of externals in religion. Unless you wear a certain kind of dress, you can't be regarded as a true Christian. All these dangerous observances of externals are nothing more than a substitute for real Christianity, because Christianity is not a matter of dealing with that kind of issue. It's a matter of dealing with our own individual personal relationship to God and nothing else. And in this condition into which Paul is writing, he is saying to them, I am beginning to have fears of you, because I'm beginning to fear that maybe I was wasting my time, and all that preaching that I thought was so fruitful in reality may turn out to be fruitless. I have bestowed upon you hard, sweaty labor, and it's all been for nothing. That's the situation in the churches of Galatia. That's the situation that has recurred in churches down through the generations. It is not a dying situation. It's not dead. This kind of situation is very much alive. I was on the verge of saying well, but it's not well, it's sick. It is very much alive and damaging in churches to this day, where there is an observance of the externals of religion and knowing nothing of the internal power, the new life that is ultimately controlled by love above all things. That's the situation. What then is the reason for this? You might say, well, Paul doesn't give us the reason. Well, he doesn't give it here, but he gives it in chapter 5, and he gives it in chapter 6 also, that we'll come to in a moment. But this is not simply an intellectual difficulty. Let's be clear on something. All kinds of backslidings and turning away from authentic Christianity is not simply an intellectual activity of the mind only. It's a moral problem. Think, for example, of the rich young ruler who came to Jesus and wanted to do something. A God-fearing young man, rich, a ruler, youth on his side. In the expectation of life, he could live for another half century or so. Everything was going for him. He was a God-fearing man. Rich young man. How many rich young men with authority do you know who are God-fearing, keeping the commandments of God? Not many. I don't know if I've met many or any at all. A man of tremendous stature. Jesus loved him, Mark tells us in his gospel. And he wanted to know, what must he do to go to heaven? Tell me what to do and I'll do it. And Jesus told him the commandments. I've kept all these. And then Jesus told him what to do. And the rich young man was found out. And he went away from Jesus sad. Now, why should he be sad, do you think? He was sad because he knew that Jesus was speaking the truth. He was sad because he knew that he was making a fool's bargain. He still believed that Jesus was the good teacher. We're not told that he became an unbeliever, an atheist. It wasn't a mental, intellectual difficulty. It was a moral problem. He loved his money more than he loved the riches of the treasures of the kingdom. And he was not going to give away his wealth to all these riffraff in the streets, the poor. Not by a long shot would he do such a thing. It was a moral problem that he had, not a mental difficulty. And it's always the same in the Christian life. I've only met one man, I've repeated this to you on a number of occasions, in my whole life, I've only met one man who has ever turned away from the gospel through an intellectual doctrinal difficulty, and that was to do with the sinlessness of Christ, a fellow student of mine in Aberdeen University. Every other case I've ever come across, and we're not pretending to have met every case, but every case we've ever come across, when you speak about it, it's the Christian life itself that's the difficulty and the problem and indeed the offense. It's living the Christian life. We can think, for example, of those disciples of Jesus of whom we read in John's Gospel chapter 6. A great multitude of them. They followed him. They saw his signs, his wonders, the bread making and the miracles and the healing. And they thought this was great. And so it was. And then Jesus began to tell them the nitty-gritty, the ordinariness of the Christian life. Eating his flesh, drinking his blood, following him wherever he would go. And at that point, you remember, they said, "This is a hard saying. We didn't bargain for this." They thought that life following Jesus was going to be full of pleasantness and free bread. And they found that there were difficulties in the way. It's difficult to live by faith and eat the bread of Christ. It's difficult to live by his blood. It's not easy to be a Christian. And sooner rather than later, there is going to come a time when we recognize that we simply have not counted the cost sufficiently well. Jesus never lied about what it meant to follow him. Foxes have holes, the birds of the air have nests, but the Son of Man has nowhere to lay his head. What king is it who is going to build a tower doesn't first of all calculate, have I got enough bricks, have I got enough money to pay laborers? Or what king going to make war doesn't calculate the size of his army against the size of the enemy army? Can I do it? Or will I have to make premature peace? Count the cost. And it's always the lack of counting the cost and facing the issue of what it really means to be a Christian that causes so many to stumble in the end. And that was what these Galatians were finding, because there were teachers who came along to them and who said there is an easier way. And the easier way is go back to Moses. You will find that everybody who turns away from the gospel, who has made a profession of faith, if they apostatize, they don't, as it were, branch out into some new way of life. They simply go back to the old habits and the old haunts, the old relationships, the old places. They go back to what they previously knew. That was the problem with the epistle to the Hebrews, you may remember. They were thinking of going back to Judaism. They weren't thinking of starting out on some easier branch of Christianity. And so they were going to fall away from Christ, back into the old religion with which they had been so familiar. And those who have been brought up in a legalistic atmosphere, when they find that the liberties of the Christian life make tremendous demands upon them, the easiest thing in the world is to go back. So what is the problem? What is the offense? It is the cross. It is the crucifixion of Christ. It is living under Calvary. It is being, as Paul has already told us at the end of chapter 2, it is being crucified with Christ. You go to chapter 5. This is why I said he gives the answer in chapter 5. You look at verse 11 in chapter 5. And I, brethren, he says to these Galatians, if I yet preach circumcision, if I preach to you that all you need to do is to be circumcised and keep certain of the rules of Moses, then he says, if that's what I preach, why am I being persecuted? What is it that is causing me to be persecuted? And we read of his persecution at Lystra, for example. Then is the offense of the cross ceased. There is an offense in the cross. There is no offense in loving your neighbor as yourself. There is no offense in the law. There is no offense in being a good neighbor. It's the cross, because the crucifixion demands that we die with Christ. That we die, we no longer live unto ourselves, but unto him who loved us and gave himself for us. We are conformed to the image of the crucified Jesus. And in chapter 6 at verse 14, Paul returns to the cross again. But God forbid that I should glory save in the cross of our Lord Jesus Christ, by whom the world is crucified unto me, and I unto the world. And there are some tremendous comments, which maybe I'll share with you when the time comes, to consider that great verse. Tremendous comments of what it means to be crucified to the world, and the world crucified unto us. So what is happening to these Galatians? Why is it that they are going back to the observance? Why do Sabbatarian emphasis? Why is it that they are emphasizing that kind of thing in order to be saved? Because it's easier to witness to Sabbath observance and to a certain way of dressing and a certain way of doing things in churches. All that's easy. The embarrassment, the shame, the difficulty, the pain comes when we begin to speak and we begin to live in the shadow of the crucified Son of God. That's where the difficulty lies. Anybody can talk about Sabbatarian observance. And why? Because religion, the natural man's religion, recognizes there are certain festivals. People sometimes say to me, you know, someone said it to me this last Christmas, I suppose this is a busy time of the year for you. And I say, no, it's not. Not at all. And they looked at me, the man. I said, we do nothing differently at Christmas time. It's no more busy than any other time. Why would the man even ask that question? Because he associates religion with observance of days. Easter, Christmas, christenings, you name it. That's what the natural man thinks about religion. And every religion in the world that men have ever invented, whether it be Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, every religion always is doing, doing, doing. The Christian faith has much more to do with being than doing. Be the children of God. And the doing will fall into place. But as long as we emphasize the doing, we are preventing ourselves from being those liberated children. And that's the real heart of the matter. And that's where the difficulty lies. And you know it as well as I do, the cost of being identified in this world against all other religious opinions of being identified with a crucified Redeemer. And so they went back. You remember in John chapter 6, they followed him no more. In the same way, the people of Israel, when they came out of the land of Egypt, out of the house of bondage, you remember they wanted to go back. Because there's a certain comfort, there's a certain assurance in rule-keeping. Just follow the rules. That's why the Roman Catholic Church, for example, as Martin Lloyd-Jones says, is the devil's masterpiece. Because it's all to do with the name of Christ surrounded by rules. Just do what the church tells you. Leave it to the priest or you'll go to heaven. And even if you don't immediately go to heaven, you might go to purgatory, experience a few centuries maybe of purgatorial cleansing, but you'll see the beatific vision. Just do what we say. That's the religion of the natural man. The observance of days and months and years, seasons. in order to be saved, in order to have peace with God. Now, we're going to see in chapter 5 that the cure for this is not the putting away of observances, because the law is fulfilled, as Paul tells us in verse 14 of chapter 5. The law is fulfilled in this word, you shall love your neighbor as yourself. So we're not saying the law of Moses has nothing to do with us. It's got everything to do with us. But it's got nothing to do with our salvation. That's the point. It's Christ alone. I was going to go on to look at the remedy. I'll say just one or two words on it. It's always a return to the cross. It always means for us practically that in Christian congregations we will resist pressure groups. And as long as I am the minister of this congregation, there will be no pressure group that is allowed to dictate to the people of this congregation that in order to be saved, they must observe the Sabbath in a particular kind of way, dress in a particular kind of way, be total abstainers in regard to the use of alcohol or any such shibboleth or taboo, because that has no place in a man or a woman's salvation. These things fall into place. And there are, as more than one good commentator points out, there are times in our modern church when a new Puritanism is desired. There's no question of that. We're far too slack and sloppy in the churches of Australia. We approach Christianity in the same way that we approach just about everything else. She'll be all right, mate. Well, it may not be all right, mate. It may be all wrong. According to Paul's teaching, it may be all wrong. This is a serious business. Do we know God? Not by keeping certain days or observances, but do we know Him by faith and repentance and a renewed heart and a loving heart? Do we observe these things with a sense of drudgery, slavery? We keep those days because the church says so and we have to, but there's no pleasure in it. Or do we keep the Sabbath day because we are pleasing Him who is our heart's desire? You see, a different religion is in view here. And that's why Paul says you're turning away to another gospel, but it's not a gospel. This observance of days is bondage to elements which are not God's. And they are not the gospel. The gospel is liberty from the power of sin, from the presence of sin, from the traditions of men, because Christ alone is the Lord of the conscience. Don't allow your conscience to be hijacked except by the claims of Christ. And it is the crucified Christ. It is at the cross of Calvary that our hearts are broken and crucified, and we see the world for the filthy thing that it is and ourselves for the filthy things that we are too. It's there at the cross. And that's why Paul is going on to say the Christian life in chapters 5 and 6. The Christian life is basically a crucified life, not the observance of days. And so that's why I emphasize these are vital verses, because this is really what Galatians is all about. You did not know God, but now you have known God. Don't go back. How is it possible that if you're a child, a son, you want to be a slave again? Why? It's because you're evading the heart of Christianity. That's why. You're evading and you're refusing to die a death that must be died before we can live unto God. I am crucified with Christ, says Paul. Unless I'm finishing. I have been crucified with Christ. Nevertheless, I live, yet not I, but Christ lives in me. And the life that I now live in the flesh, I live by faith in the Son of God who loved me and gave Himself for me. And later on in this epistle, Paul is going to say, that his desire and his anxiety is that Christ be formed in them and that they begin to live and begin, in a sense, to look like the children of God. They begin to look like Christ. But I must stop. My ears are popping and my voice sounds very strange in my own ears. What it sounds like in yours, I'm not sure, but I will leave it there. May God bless to us his own holy word.